ever since I was a child, I was like, oh, I'm just going to live in New York, so I'm just never going to learn how to drive.
Wait,
and I never learned how to drive.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a portrait of comedian and SNL writer Julio Torres. If you've watched SNL at all over the last year, then you definitely know the work of Julio Torres. Torres is a Salvadoran stand-up comedian and writer for Saturday Night Live. You can almost always tell when you're watching one of his pieces because of his, well, his unique sense of humor. His skits include one from the point of view of a gaudy bathroom sink.
Am I too much? Oh my God. Simply too much. I'm gigantic.
Or the skit Melania Moments.
Melania Trump approached a window in Trump Tower and gazed down on Fifth Avenue. She saw a man walk just out of sight and wondered, what happens to them? To the people once they leave Fifth Avenue? Where do they go? Do they disappear? Is there a Sixth Avenue? Is there a Fourth Avenue?
So my relationship with Saturday Night Live is like any romantic relationship, mm-hmm. long term. Mm-hmm. There's ups and downs.
Yes.
Like the whole Latino thing, mm-hmm. rather the absence of, you know, it just kind of gets to you. But then this guy that I actually know and love, Lin-Manuel Miranda, mm-hmm. is asked to host the show. And there's this one scene that I just watched, and I was like, oh my God, I love this so much. It's Lin-Manuel as the recent immigrant in a phone booth.
Hello, mama. Hi, mama. ¿Qué tal estás?
And then, you know, it's supposed to be the American dream, right? But then quickly it becomes the American nightmare all around disgusting food.
Los americanos comen algo que se llama marshmallow salad. Marshmallow salad. No vegetales, marshmallows.
Right. I don't think his character saw it as disgusting. I think that he was fascinated by it. Yes. I think he has nothing but love for this new world that he has encountered. And he's very wide-eyed.
Preston me mostró lugares bonitos en North Dakota como el Walmart, el 7-Eleven, el Cornfield, el otro Walmart, el otro 7-Eleven.
It seemed like the skits that you write for Saturday Night Live are always kind of like looking from the outside in.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely feel your cultural observation, which is why, as I look at your work, there's a lot of times when I felt like I intuitively connected with it because of the fact that you have this kind of outsider's gaze. How do you understand that?
I'm aware of it. It was not designed that way, if that makes sense.
Talk to me about your El Salvador.
Well, let's see. I've lived in San Salvador my whole life. It's not until I moved to New York, which is the only other place I've lived in, that you sort of look back on it and start questioning, but also just seeing it through a different lens. I was lucky enough that my parents worked really hard and they could put me in a nice, very posh elementary school and high school.
So like a private school?
Yes, a private school, yeah.
How did the other kids from San Salvador look at you?
I was not social at all. I did not get along with the other kids. It was never like hostile, but it was always just a mutual understanding that we were different and that we just had very little to say to each other. So I would stay in my room, and like my childhood was just being in my room and playing alone.
Well, let me ask you about that. You say that the other kids, like, it was, like, mutual distance.
Yes. Distance is a nice way to put it, yeah.
What do you think that they saw in you that made them want to be like, yeah, ese Julio?
Well, I think homogeny is such an important part of the Salvadorian experience, at least in my experience. People are very comfortable with people being a certain way. Of them looking a certain way, of them acting a certain way, of them being interested in a certain thing. And then when you add to that a layer of private school, that turns into what kind of car do your parents have? Where do you vacation? And like all of these things that become so important in terms of how people see you.
So like constant judgment.
Constant judgment.
See, people don't think of El Salvador and think of
constant judgment.
Wait a minute, how judgmental are those Salvadoreños?
Look, El Salvador is a very, very conservative country. El Salvador is deeply conservative, very, very Christian. And in my experience, some people are going to get very mad at me for saying this, but in my experience, quite intolerant as well. Now I have a younger sister who lives there, and I see just like pictures of her and her friends on Instagram, and I think, wow, things have changed a lot. Because, you know, she's this cool designer. Her hair color changes every week. She has so many gay friends. And they seem to be going out and about and having the time of their lives. So I think, wow, that was not my experience.
Your experience was?
My experience was one of, like, if you don't look and behave and are like everyone else, then just sort of quietly stay away. I think that kids can smell that something's up. I played with Barbies. I kept that at home. But my mother was very encouraging of just letting me play with whatever I wanted to play. Which it wasn't until I grew up that I realized just how revolutionary that is. For my mom and my dad, who are both from pretty conservative households, to be like, oh, no, he wants the doll. He's going to get the doll. But all of that life felt like I got to live all of those like very fulfilling fantasies in the confines of my own bedroom. You know what it felt like? It felt like I was just waiting for this limbo to be over, childhood and adolescence to be over, because those are not the parts for me.
Did you know that you wanted to leave El Salvador?
Or? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
God,
absolutely.
That you're so definitive about that.
Oh, my God. Ever since I was a child, I was like, oh, I'm just going to live in New York, so I'm just never going to learn how to drive.
Wait,
and what? I never learned how to drive. I was like, I'm going to live in New York, and I'm never going to learn how to drive.
I mean, you're in El Salvador. Now, mm-hmm. You're not even in the capital. Can you just paint a picture of one of those daydreams that you had about, and then I'm going to move to, you know, because it's completely...
Designing the floor plan of my apartment.
Oh, my God, what?
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's like an apartment that I'm never going to have. But, like, just, like, sketching a little penthouse.
Yeah. It was a penthouse?
Oh, yeah, of course it was
a penthouse. Dude, you had no idea about the real cost
of things. Oh, no. And then I'm like, okay, so Brooklyn then. It's like, okay, and that's fine. That's great. Yeah, I mean, because mind you, this was informed by TV and movies.
All right, so which TV?
I didn't know anyone who lived in New York.
So what TV shows, what movies were you watching that you were like, that's my New York?
Not even like one specific movie. It's just that every stupid movie that America dumps into Latin America is set in New York.
In a city where everyone's looking for someone.
When an uptown girl.
She's great.
Gets fixed up with...
But when you least expect it,
nice.
Fate can open the door.
These, like, romantic comedies that I can't even name, you know, they're, like, hailing a taxi and doing all that, and that seemed like, oh, that's where life is.
Coming up, my conversation with Julio Torres continues.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Scott.
Another crazy week. We've got North Korea.
Yep, we got Russia.
Midterms.
And, of course, President Trump. And what happens whenever there is crazy news that erupts? We pop into the studio and break it down to make sense.
So if you see a headline...
We've discussed it.
It's the NPR Politics Podcast.
Hey, we're back. And when we left off, comedian Julio Torres was telling us about his upbringing in El Salvador and how he made his way to New York. And now we're going to turn to his comedy and how he got started and eventually got on to Saturday Night Live. Okay, so take me from the dream to how you get here.
I applied to the new school. They gave me a scholarship that wasn't enough. So then I kept going to school down in El Salvador. Then a couple of years later, I reapplied and they gave me more money, which still wasn't enough, but just enough to make it work. I came here and it was like every semester felt like, is this going to be the one that ends it all? And I just thought, no, I just have to get straight A's and make it to graduation and then someone's going to give me a job.
And what were you studying at the new school?
Oh, well, the most marketable career of all. It was a literature degree. So here I was, like, broke kid from Latin America, being like, oh, I will better myself with a degree in literature. Which I think to my dad was like, you're just finding the most difficult possible route to take. You want to go to the most expensive country in the world, the most expensive city in that country, and study this thing that's not going to give you a job. But to me, it was like, well, I'm just killing time. I'm still just killing time. I just need a bridge. I just need more time until I can become a writer.
I love the fact that you were like, I'm almost there.
It's just a moment. It really felt like an hourglass had been turned or something, and it was just like, I just need more time. Oof. After I graduate, the myth that me getting straight A's was going to give me a job quickly dissipated. The government gives you 1 year to find a sponsor that'll sponsor you for a work visa. I bluffed my way into an art archivist job, and that gave me a work visa, and I did that for, I think, 4 years.
Where does comedy suddenly make its way into? Because you haven't mentioned comedy.
I haven't mentioned comedy at all.
You were more like a sad kid. Like,
yes. Yeah, correct. I didn't want to be a stand-up comedian till the day before I tried it. I wanted to write movies, and I wanted to write TV, and I wanted to write theater. Comedies. But I didn't know how to go about doing that. And then suddenly, and I can't even remember how the thought entered my head, I was like, well, what about stand-up comedy? Because then I don't have to pay anyone. I don't have to go to any classes. I don't have to ask anyone's permission. I don't have to collaborate with anyone. It's on my own schedule. So then I Googled comedy open mic New York City.
Oh, my God. That sounds frightening in and of itself.
And then did it. Yeah.
Did you write anything, or did you were you just like, oh, I'll wing
oh,
it?
Oh, no.
You had it written.
Oh, no, I'm a terrible improviser. And I did it, and I probably didn't go great, but I liked it.
Do you remember, like, one of the jokes that you told in that first night of stand-up comedy?
I don't remember the jokes. I do remember the subject matter. It was, like, very observational humor about the people who would come to an art museum where I was working at the time. And I did something about how, like, it felt like witnessing live New Yorker cartoons. There was this one lady who turned to this other lady as she's putting on, like, the heaviest coat. And they're both pretty elderly, and they're both, like, kind of hunched over. And she's like, remind me to send you that article about standing and how good it is for you. And I thought that was just so funny that was just a snippet I caught.
When you went up for stand-up that very first time, was it the Julio that we now know in stand-up? Because
no.
Your character in your stand-up now is pretty trippy.
No, it wasn't. It was that version of me trying to look and act normal, if that makes sense. I would take the mic out of the stand, and then I would, like, lean on it, just sort of, like, mimicking the body movements of what I thought a stand-up comedian should have. I would just, like, try to look like I was having the easiest time of my life. And then it was almost like as I got more comfortable being me, I got more comfortable being uncomfortable.
In my experience, the hardest part about being vegan is all of the apologizing. People ask me if I miss meat or dairy. I mean, I miss being liked.
But in part, it's also developing a character.
Accidentally, but yes.
is that character?
I, like many or most stand-up comedians, I'm sort of like an exaggerated version of myself on stage. There's something I think childlike about what I do. Very sort of like, oh, I'm not going to run after the ball. I'm just going to stand here and do what I do and be utterly inflexible. And if you like it, great. And if you don't like it, well, that'll bum me out a little bit, but you won't know that.
I'm sorry if I seem a little bit out of it right now. I just got my lab results back. And just as every doctor suspected, I'm simply too much.
It's almost like me before I became comfortable with like human interaction, which didn't come till very late in my life. Me before I felt comfortable like slouching on a couch in front of people.
Why? Because slouching on a couch?
I don't know. Like, I felt like just little things about communicating with people and being around people came so, so late to me.
You're looking around like there's something that you want to...
It's almost like something that I want to demonstrate, but I don't know. I feel like by the time I graduated high school, I was still so not used to just being relaxed around people. I was one very, very tight.
So you're living the dream in many
ways. I'm happy.
Ways. Yeah. Within the dream that you have achieved, what's the thing that you're like, oh my God, pinch me, this really did just happen? What would be that moment?
You know, I don't really get that way.
Seriously?
Yeah. I guess because I'm always thinking about like, well, this is good, but...
What's the but? But I could get hit by a truck tomorrow?
No. But there's this other thing I want to do.
But I want to write a movie.
But I want to write...
This is good,
exactly.
But I want to... And so what's the dream right now?
I don't know if it's a dream, but I have been writing a movie or starting to write a movie for a while, and I want to get into that. Fred Armisen and I have a pilot together, and hopefully that'll become a show. That would be great.
And it's in Spanish, right?
It's in Spanish, yeah.
And how do you feel about doing a show that's fully in Spanish when your writing is really mostly in English, your comedic writing?
You know, I had never performed comedy in Spanish just because I left before I was fully developed. But I loved it. And there are certain things that you can get away with that you can't really get away with in English. It's exciting to dive into sort of that point of view. For a moment, just so giddy to like make these observations that couldn't work if they weren't in a show in Spanish.
Julio, thank you so much for joining me on Latino USA.
Thank you for having me. This was so great.
You can catch the work of Julio Torres on Saturday Night Live or with Fred Armisen in the upcoming Spanish language comedy from HBO, Los Spookies. This episode was produced by Sayer Quevedo and edited by Sofia Paliza Carr. The Latino USA team includes Marlon Bishop, Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, and Janice Yamoka, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. Our engineers are Ginny Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music that you heard on this episode, be sure you stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. And I'll see you there. Hasta la próxima. Chao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation. Change for families by families. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
My daughter is vegan.
Great.
Really?
Yeah.
You think so?
I think so.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA. We hear about the aftermath of the dictatorship in Argentina and the story of one family's search for a missing grandson. That's next time on Latino USA.
Our Up First team goes to work while you're sleeping. That way you wake up to the freshest take on the day's news. It's the 10-minute morning news podcast from NPR. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.